My name is Darlene Stoltz. It is June the 16th, 2019. I'm here in Hudson, New York with Audrey Berman. Audrey, please introduce yourself.
Sure. My name is Audrey Berman. I live in Germantown, New York, and I work here in Hudson.
So why don't we begin with you telling me how you happen to be in Hudson.
Yeah. I always wonder where to start with these questions. But yes, I would say most recently, so I went to school in New York City. I studied architecture there. And then after I graduated, I ended up connecting to a nonprofit that was based in Hudson at that time called the Greenhorns. They used to have an office here. And so I would work full-time in the city, and then I would come up on the weekends and do work here as well on the weekends. So I was really interested in the work that that nonprofit was doing, mostly to recruit young farmers into sustainable agriculture. There's a lot of agriculture in this region, and so they were sort of the kind of media networking organization to sort of get people into that door, into the door of farming. So yeah, eventually after working with them for about a year, I made my way up to Dutchess County, so one county south of here, to apprentice on a farm. I worked on that farm for 2 years. Then I worked on another farm just outside of the town in the city of Hudson called Letterbox Farm. And then since that time, that was 2015, I've been mostly in this area in Hudson and Germantown. And then in September of last year, part of the work that I do is around food access. And so we opened up a mobile grocery store in the city of Hudson last September. And then we opened up a brick and mortar store as of March 5th of this year. So my work right now is predominantly in Hudson, even though I do work in the county, and that's what it's been over the last 4 or 5 years. It's been countywide.
So I'm wondering where the interest in this type of work has come from, food access, farming.
Yeah. I think most of my life I was looking for something to ground me or to connect me to a place, because my parents are immigrants. So they came to this country as teenagers. My parents, my grandparents, and my grandparents all came from the former Soviet Union as Jewish refugees. And so they ended up in Chicago, and it was a place that they didn't have any connection to. It was the first time that they've lived in that place. So, that manifested in my experience, too, as a young person, where we were all kind of learning how to be American together. I was born shortly after they came here. And, so I would say, not really knowing that as a young person, but looking back, I can say what I was searching for was a way to sort of ground and connect to a place, not having any roots in this place, through my family. So that's sort of the deeper reason of why I'm really attracted to this work. And nature has been, connecting to nature, whether that's through agriculture or just through living in this place and being outside in various ways, is very healing for me, as someone who doesn't always feel comfortable in this place. So that that's part of the draw as well. And then also just having the really tangible skills of being able to grow food and provide food for myself, for other people. And then now in this sort of next phase of my career, not being the one growing the food, but actually sort of making the food that is grown here accessible to everybody because of gentrification, because of income inequality. It's not possible for that food to be affordable or accessible in other ways to all the people living here. And at the same time, the farmers are really doing their best to make that food available. And there's just a disjointed way in which the price that the farmer needs and then the affordability for most folks just doesn't combine, and that really is rooted in an industrial agricultural system that our government supports and funds and subsidizes really heavily. There's many sort of layers to that onion of why I'm interested in this work, and I'm grateful to have learned those tangible skills and then to have now sort of transferred that knowledge into a different way of supporting people. It's like personal healing and like collective healing at the same time, which I'm really grateful that I have the privilege to do that through my work. I feel honored to be in that role so much. I wake up every day really grateful for the work that I'm able to do, the people I get to meet, my coworkers who are incredible humans. Yeah. And food is so, it's just so central to everyone's life. And so many, you know, we're all variously disconnected or connected, and it's so complicated and it's so deep, the challenges and the opportunities as well are really exciting. So I feel like we're in a really good place, we meaning the people that I work with, and just having a grocery store in Hudson after over 15 years of not having one feels really incredible, powerful, and humbling to be part of that project.
So your family and the community, I want to try to tie these two mm-hmm. together. What has been the feedback from family members and from the community here in Hudson that, mm-hmm. that you're serving? What are they saying to you about you doing this work?
Yeah. I think it took a while for my family to understand what I was doing because they came as refugees. It was mostly because of political or it was a governmental wide oppression where it was systemic, where they didn't have the same kind of opportunities for jobs that most Russians did. And so the goal of coming to this country was to be able to have financial opportunity, job mobility, all of that. And so there was a lot of pressure as a young person to do something that would make me successful in their eyes. And that mostly translated to some sort of financial wealth. And for me, that never felt right or felt like it sat with my heart. And I recognize that I have a different perspective. I didn't grow up where they grew up, and so I don't have to bear that struggle or that challenge in the way that they did. And so I was able to sort of forge my own path. And while I was farming, it was actually, yeah, that was probably the most challenging part for them to really understand why I'd want to do that, because it is so hard to make a living. But I think now that since I've been running my own nonprofit and working with other nonprofits collaboratively, it's become clear to them that this is really right for me, and that I'm really happy, and that's sort of what they've landed on as being really important to witness, that, you know, as long as I'm happy and I can take care of myself, then that's, you know, they're grateful for that. But it's been interesting to sort of feel like an outsider in my own family, that I haven't followed this path that they had, you know, hoped or expected for me. And then here, I would say, I mean, the feedback is just continually positive and overwhelmingly just praise, like so much praise. And every day that I work in the store, it's constant. And it can be a little bit overwhelming at times, but it's this constant reiteration that what we're doing is what we're supposed to be doing. And that feels great to get that validation that we've made the right decisions, and we're always questioning what we're doing and trying to improve and be better. And it's a constant process, but overall, it's just the community has been very positive and in support of what's happened. And a lot of that is because the folks involved worked with a community group for for 2.5 years before we even opened or thought about opening a store, basically. So we wanted to move really slowly. We actually have a lot of meetings in this room here, monthly, either in this room or the one on the first floor, to figure out what needed to happen, what opportunities were available, how to actually get a store open that would be accessed by as many people as possible.
So what is your vision as you are forging ahead? What do you hope will be, what do you see as the long-term what is your vision for the future?
That's always hard for me, because I'm such a details, day-to-day, on-the-ground person, that I really love figuring stuff out that's really tangible, and organizing processes, and just getting things done where I can see, okay, I did this task and now it's complete. And I have, you know, there's obviously a vision for the future, and there's something that or that I would love to see some version of it come into fruition. It just feels, it's always hard for me to put that broad idea out, because then my mind immediately starts to think, well, how do I make that happen? What are all the steps? So, but I would just say that we are working towards creating a community food hub in Hudson. We received a large state grant. The whole city received that grant. It's called the Downtown Revitalization Initiative, in the Bridge District by the water. And this community food hub, which is a collaborative project, received a portion of that funding. And we're doing some preliminary research right now. But the idea is that we would either purchase or construct a building that is an aggregation and distribution center. So we could purchase at a much larger scale from many of the farms in the area and sell to more institutional buyers. So places like hospitals and schools that farmers can't access now because they don't grow enough quantity themselves to supply the demand. And so part of that vision is to increase the market for farmers, so creating more sales outlets for them, potentially even custom growing with them, contracting them to grow certain crops, and having a reliable business model where they know they're going to sell X amount to us every year. So that's one piece of it. And then the part that I'm really excited about would be processing in that facility. So whether that's meat processing or with produce, turning that into sort of grab and go meals, really accessible prepared foods, or even just chopped foods. So having it mildly processed, where it's even easier for people who maybe don't have time or all of the skills to do the cooking. And a lot of that can be done with surplus food, with blemished foods. So it's really, once you have a facility with a kitchen and coolers and freezers and storage and staff, knowledgeable staff who can do that, you start to be able to do so much more. And that's been a really challenging part of what we've been doing, is sort of this desire to grow and to expand and to service more people in different ways, and being really limited by infrastructure. And the other really important piece of that project, and what I would love, I mean, just would love to see more of, is job creation, affordable job or living wage job creation. So above whatever the minimum wage is. So really, to me, that's one of the more systemic issues, where if people aren't getting paid a living wage, how can they afford to take care of their basic needs, food included? And in the process, the idea is that there's training people into various jobs, into skill sets. One of my colleagues is really passionate about open hiring, so formerly incarcerated individuals, mm-hmm. being able to just have an open door policy where there's really thoughtful and hands-on training that goes into supporting people into different jobs. So that's sort of in the works, and really that's all tied to, I would say, a broader strengthening of our food shed and our community, so that, you know, everyone sort of has opportunity to thrive as humans in this world. So food is kind of the medium by which I would like to create that kind of world. But it's not, you don't just have to do it through food. There's so many other ways. But in a city like Hudson that's rapidly gentrifying, it's just really scary to see the economy being built on tourism and surplus wealth. You know, to have a tourism industry, you have to have people who have money that's just expendable. And I don't believe that that's going to last forever. We look at climate change, if we look at our government, if we look at all of these things, to me that feels so unstable. It's like the foundation is really shaky. So I love opportunities that prioritize the people living in a place, prioritize their needs above people visiting and figuring out how to have living wage jobs, and have the stores and the network and the systems in a community to get all the things that you need to live. If you don't have a grocery store, it's like, how can you support yourself? How can you feed your family? That makes like going to get food so much harder, and it shouldn't be hard. It's just like it's a human right to have food. That's the broad and expansive and complex vision, I would say. And it's still a process. It's, you know, I try not to, I believe that I have skills to offer, but I really prioritize hearing what other people's needs are and working, you know, in service of that, to figure out what resources and capacities do I have, and how can I use that to create what the broader community is desiring or says that they are in need of. Because I'm not from here, so I tread very lightly around, you know, what I think should happen versus what the people who have been living here for most of their lives believe should happen.
So that's the broad vision, hope. What does the the day-to-day look like in comparison to that broader vision?
Yeah. So right now I'm involved predominantly in two projects. One is a gleaning program that I've been running now for, it's the fourth season this year. We start on Monday. The way that that works is we have a network of over 40 farms in Columbia County and Dutchess County. And so it's myself and there's a coordinator that manages that. We pick up their surplus food that they can't sell or for whatever reason, you know, is blemished, or it's generally all very high quality produce that's grown mostly organically. And then that gets distributed out to different food pantries and community organizations in those same counties. About 30, we're at 31 right now, different distribution sites. That happens Monday and Tuesday, June through November. So 2 days a week for about half the year. And that was sort of how I got started into this work. Having worked on farms, I saw the abundance that we grew and how much didn't actually make it out onto people's plates. And that felt really, that was just hard to, I had this really like visceral moment the first time that I harvested radishes on a farm where every other radish we picked out was blemished and we just left it in the field. And, you know, it's okay because it's fertility going back in the soil, but it's food that we worked so hard to grow to see that not being consumed by people was really, it stuck with me. And I personally like grew up with grandparents who lived during World War II, and so there's a lot of scarcity around food that was passed down to me. So I now have a layered understanding of why that moment was also so hard. Even though I grew up never having to worry about food, it's sort of how we as a family communicated about food and shared food and the expectation of always having to eat everything that was in front of me. It didn't matter if I was full. So yeah, those are kind of the two things that sort of led me into seeing an opportunity there and how that could be utilized towards supporting the emergency food system in the area, which, you know, is not a long-term solution. It's just sort of feeding into this system that exists of food pantries for folks who are relying on that for a number of reasons. So we do that. And so that's coming up and we're excited. And I've hired a new coordinator for that. So we'll be up at 7:30 making the rounds in our cargo van in the county, seeing all the farmers again and all the coordinators. It's incredible how many people we interact with and how much impact can really just happen in a day. I'm still amazed by it. And then, yeah, so I'm more peripherally involved. I do a lot of fundraising to make that happen. I'm going to go out on the route for the first 2 weeks and sort of get our new employee onboarded, and then, you know, she's basically gonna handle that herself, and that feels really good to sort of be now employing people and delegating that to others. So my day-to-day mostly now is with Rolling Grocer 19, which is our grocery store in Hudson. I work one shift a week at the register, so just checking folks out, and then every day kind of varies, but we have standing meetings 2 days a week with my my co-directors. There's three of us that work together. It's myself, Michelle Hughes, and Celia Graham, who I believe have all been interviewed with Oral History Summer School in the past. And we're trying to do promotion into low-income communities in Hudson. That's been a challenge. We thought that just by being down street on South Second, pretty close to subsidized housing, that we'd have more of that demographic shopping, and it hasn't been the case. And that's something that we're actively trying to figure out how to change. When we were in our mobile trailer, we would pull up right in front of the high rise, and we had a lot more folks coming using their EBT. And so we're trying to figure out, you know, what the disconnect is. But also, we've only been open for 3 months, so we're also aware that it will take time for people to learn about us. But yeah, really a like concerted and thoughtful effort around promotion. That's really exciting. We're expanding our products, so we're talking a lot about what to carry and also how that affects who comes in and what they're familiar with, and really trying to be appealing to all the different cultures that live in the city. And there's fundraising that's happening. There's planning for the next year. We just put a budget together for the next fiscal year, and sort of visioning out what that would look like. So hiring more staff, expanding hours, just a lot of sort of like future, immediate kind of future planning, and then also day-to-day stuff where I'm sort of the handy person at the store and I need to hang signs and, you know, fix different things that are falling apart. And yeah, we want to readjust the store a little bit, so get some more coolers in. So it's a lot of, you know, just figuring the stuff out that needs to happen in the moment, and doing that in a very timely fashion, and then sort of, yeah, layering out in time, you know, a month out, 2 months out. We're planning a grand opening party in September. We want to close down the block and barbecue and have farm animals and music, DJ. That'll be really fun. And one of my colleagues, she does education. So she just proposed this beautiful year-long education program, cooking family meals and movie nights and just skill building. So yeah, all the way out to a year plus, you know, really figuring out what's going to happen. And yeah, we just hired 3 new people. Cheyenne, Michaela, and Amari, two of them grew up in Hudson. Cheyenne went to high school here. They all basically went to school together. They're in their early 20s, so it's fun that they're all in there now together, and just getting them settled, and for myself and my team, learning how to work with people, you know, to hire new people and onboard them and make sure that everyone's taken care of, because we, aside from making food accessible, we also want to have the kind of business and organization that is equitable on many levels and supports all different kinds of people. And so, you know, making sure that we're accommodating of just us being humans. You know, one of our new employees is a mother, you know, and one of my co-directors is a mother of 7 children. And so we're very family oriented and aware that there's just things that come up that many businesses that are driven by, you know, by capitalism don't really care about people's lives and accommodate for the needs that people have, and we don't want to do that. And we have the benefit of being a nonprofit, and we can fundraise and have more space for that. And I'm really excited about developing that out and really learning from the people that we hire that are working with us, you know, how to support them best, and have that flexibility to do what needs to be done in the, you know, even if it's last minute or not. But just, we're all different people with different needs, and you know, I have a chronic illness, and I can't, you know, overwork myself to a certain capacity, otherwise I can't work at all. And so I bring that to our workplace, you know, just so that no one feels like they're ever too far in where they are sacrificing their health or their well-being That was a lot. Yeah, it's a lot going on. It's funny. Sometimes I think, oh, there's not that much happening, but there's so much happening. And when I say it all now, I'm realizing, yeah, it's a lot.
I'm interested in how the sliding scale works and how the community is or has been made aware of the sliding scale in terms of the cost of things.
Yeah, so when folks come in for the first time, we have a big sign, and we use combined household income with a set of social factors to encourage people to select one of three tiers. It's blue, orange, and green. Blue is wholesale prices, so basically what we pay, we pass that on. We mark it up a tiny bit, 1 or 2%. Orange is sort of between wholesale and retail, and then green is just retail prices. We say to people at this point, if you don't have trouble buying food, if you have a car, you can get to the grocery store, like you should shop in green. If you're on any sort of public assistance, you could shop in blue. We don't ask for any sort of information, proof. We just trust that people make an honest decision, and that's been really interesting to see go down, because it is a small community, and we do know a lot of people that go in there. And yeah, it's been a learning process for us to figure out how to most clearly communicate what we're doing and what we mean, with this tiered pricing system. And so we've had to sort of change it a little bit over time and really get clear about, these social factors being really important, maybe even a more important part of deciding where you fall, more than what you make, more than what your income is. If you come from wealth, if you come from privilege, if you are a white person in this country, you're going to have a different set of opportunities than other people, and we want to say that like as delicately as possible. And it's really interesting to it's like people are shopping for food, they don't necessarily want a lesson in like structural racism or income inequality or all of these things that I think are really important and think about a lot, but not a lot of not I don't know not I mean, some people don't want to confront that and confront their wealth or confront their privilege. Maybe they don't have the capital, but they could have access to more wealth if they wanted to. And so that's been painful and enlightening to see play out. And we try really hard not to make assumptions about people. But I know the demographics in Hudson. I know that it's like 44% white in this town. And the breakdown within our tiers doesn't reflect, we're not, our shoppers are predominantly white, and that's also like not our mission. That's not our goal. And so we're trying to figure out the reasons why. Yeah, I was saying that earlier, but it's also confusing for folks to like see three prices and they're just like, how much does this cost? And I'm like, well, actually there's this whole thing you have to like be briefed on, and they're like, no, I just want to know how much this costs. So it's a new thing. It's sort of radical for a grocery store, and we're trying to figure out, the best way to introduce this concept to people and to not turn anyone off. And we still have to fundraise to make those two subsidized tiers available. And so some people, I think, used to think like, oh, if I shop at the retail price, I'm subsidizing someone else. It's like, no, you're just actually keeping the lights on. You're, you know, if we were just a regular grocery store, that's what all the prices would be, and that would help us, you know, run our business. But instead, we have to fundraise to sort of make up that gap. But interestingly enough, we have about a third. I think we have about 1,000 people that are like regular shoppers that are signed up, and it's a third in each tier. So about 330 in each one. So it's interesting how it sort of evened out. It used to be a little more weighted to blue, and I'm the lowest tier, and I just knew that that wasn't real, that it shouldn't be that. So it also points to, I think, how everyone feels some form of scarcity, and wherever you are financially, it's easy to sort of convince yourself of the struggle and the pinch, but I really wonder how to make folks aware that whatever tightness they might be feeling is very different than what other people might be feeling. Like, if you've never had to figure out how to get to the grocery store, you know, that's a fucking privilege, you know, in this town. So it's a process. And I would say overall, it's good and it's working, and there's a lot of work to do. And so some of our future planning is around having conversations around income inequality, having workshops or events, or, you know, just having bigger community conversations about what income inequality is, and just making folks more aware of where they might really fall in that spectrum.
I'm thinking about your reference to having a chronic illness and all of the activities that you are involved in, mm-hmm. for the purpose of making sure that your vision is fulfilled. How are you balancing mm-hmm. Your personal need to be well,
yeah.
and at the same time maintaining a business? Like, what does that downtime, or mm-hmm. do you have downtime? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely, I have to. And it's imperative that I do, because then I literally cannot, I have to sleep for 14 hours a day. It's I have chronic Lyme disease, but I have strong boundaries around how much I can work, and I also am really thoughtful about when I am working how effective I am being and efficient. And you know, I can get a lot of stuff done. I get really focused, and I can just crunch it out, and that's maybe not the best thing, but at least it's a style that I've gotten in the habit of doing, I think from farming and also from architecture school, which is really rigorous. But I'd rather, like, when I'm doing my work, just focus on it and get it done, and then have time to relax. And you know, I have a banya, which is a Russian sauna that I built with my grandfather in my backyard. And that's really, it's an important part of my healing practice, is being able to sweat in there, and taking a lot of baths. And yeah, it's like with Lyme, you want to heat your body up. Like, it helps manage the spirochetes, the infection. Yeah, and just being, especially this time of year, being outside when I can, I like just going to different creeks and reading and trying not to overstimulate myself. That's part of the management too, is if I get overstimulated, it can get really stressful and uncomfortable. And also just learning how to manage stress. When we were opening the store, there was a lot, even more, that was happening. And I found that I started to have a, they're called flare-ups with Lyme. So all these symptoms started coming up for me, and it was the first time that that really happened after I had a really long year-plus period of feeling awful. And it was good to sort of recognize, oh, I'm needing to sleep more. Oh, my brain cognitively isn't working in the same way that it was, and I need to figure out how to just calm my body down and not hold on to stress in ways that I'm more prone to. So yeah, eating good foods. I make bone broth every week and drink that every day, part of my practice. Yeah, just trying to enjoy life. And I struggle with sort of like in this capitalist culture, this like notion that it's like we must always be working, and especially if it's like in an activist community, it's even stronger pressure to do more. And I've really had to resist that, and it's been so hard. I feel guilt a lot of times when I'm not working, because I think, oh, I should be doing this or that, or there's a million things that I could be doing. But if I succumb to that pressure and I do it again, like I said, I won't be able to do much work at all. So that's sort of the constant earworm in my brain circling around, like, what is going to be good for me, which is eventually, you know, going to be beneficial for everyone that I work with, versus, yeah, that pressure and that drive to do everything.
So what does your support system, the human beings, what does that look like?
Yeah.
Who are those people?
Yeah. That's a tough one. I wish there were more. It's been, yeah, kind of a lonely process. My family all lives in Chicago. I have an aunt and uncle in New York City. So they're my closest relatives. And we see each other maybe once a month, once every 2 months. But yeah, it's been hard to ask friends for support, and also not really knowing what I need support with sometimes, because a lot of it is just needing to be alone. And sort of retreating. But I also find that I can get too far in that retreating place where I would actually benefit from seeing a friend and just talking to them. And yeah, I'm still trying to learn about this, you know, Lyme disease and how it manifests in me specifically, because it's different for everybody. Yeah, and so over time, you know, what I need and how it changes in my body and what the support will look like as that evolves. But yeah, I'm single. I don't have a partner. I haven't had a partner in 3 years, and that's, I got sick about 4 years ago. So it's been hard to not have someone around for that. I have other friends who have Lyme too, and so I would say they're the like closest support, in the sense of like talking through what's happening and trying to figure out what to do about it. My friend just wrote this beautiful book called Tick Magic. She's an herbalist and sort of outlines her experience and then some like really tangible tools for either preventing getting any sort of tick-borne infections, or, you know, trying to deal with it if you do have it. But it's so complex, and the medical industry is just not where it needs to be in terms of supporting that. So that's really a shame. I feel like I've had to treat myself through alternative practitioners, taking supplements and herbs and really was the lifestyle change too, just having to like cut down on work so much. But yeah, that's been the hardest part, is trying to figure it out on my own, you know, with other people. But you know, there's not, it's not a straight line or a straight path. Like trusting that I'll figure it out with a broader network of people who are also just trying to figure it out too. Yeah.
So do you know what you need?
Yeah, right now I feel supported and able to access the tools and the time and space to heal. Yeah. Sunshine would be nice. That's a big part of it. It's been a really rainy, cloudy, cool spring, and the week out doesn't look any warmer or sunnier, so we'll see if that happens.
The time is going very quickly, so we have roughly about 10-15 minutes.
Okay.
I want to ask you to share your thoughts on how you have changed from childhood to now. So, or maybe not. Like what?
Yeah.
What has that been like from your early years to where you are now?
Yeah. It's funny. I feel most connected to my younger self now, I think, than I ever have. Or that, yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting question. Yeah, I've changed so much, and also, like, my spirit is the same. Sort of, like, young and, like, in my heart, and playful, and desiring of love and acceptance, and, yeah. It's funny, I was like, I'm not gonna cry today. And then I saw the tissues, and I cried in my last interview too, or teared up. I'm not, yeah. It's funny. Childhood is really, it's painful for me to think about. It was my parents divorced when I was young, and yeah, just a lot was hard. So that's still with me. So that hasn't changed much. But I feel like I understand who I am so much better, because when you're a kid, you're just kind of, you're like more embodied and you're just doing your thing. And but I had all these questions when I was a kid that I didn't know, that I didn't even think of them as questions necessarily. It was just sort of like the world was what it was, and I wondered why my world was that way. And I've done a lot of work to figure out the answers to those questions that I didn't know the question of, if that makes sense. And it's been really healing to know why I feel a certain way, or why I felt a certain way. This is all really vague. It's hard. I don't, there's a lot that I could get into, but I would say the most valuable thing that's happened to me in the last year was meeting who is now a friend. Her name's Sophia. She's my age, and she lives in Oakland. We met on the internet, of all places. And I've never had an internet friend before until now, and she has the same family immigration story as myself. So a lot of Soviet Jews came to this country in the 80s and the 90s, and so her family was one of them. She was actually born in Moscow and came here when she was five. And it's just been so beautiful to talk to her and to, because I didn't grow up with any other Soviet Jews outside of my family. And it's this, it's kind of a really unique experience that we had. And so to find someone else who I can talk to about that, and we can sort of be like, oh, wow, that thing that my family does, your family does that too. And that's really cool. And like answers a lot of the questions around that that we've just had around why we are the way we are and thinking that we're super weird and fucked up. And, you know, it's like, oh, your family's kind of fucked up in the same way too. That's cool. We can like be support for each other. And yeah, I have so much love for her. And she just came to visit a couple weeks ago and stayed with me for a few days. And yeah, we're both queer, and we came out later in life. And so there's a lot of synergies that we share. And yeah, I'm just so grateful. I've never felt so close to another human. And I think a lot of that is just that shared understanding of where you come from. You don't have to explain it. You just get it. And that's so cool to have someone in my life like that. So I feel like through her way more in touch with my younger self, because we were like working through the questions and the challenges that we face, you know, by our family carrying a really specific kind of trauma and understanding why it happened socially, politically, religiously, you know, all of the pieces to it. So yeah. I have this, I have a wall in my dining room. It's pretty high ceiling, and just, I didn't have anything on it, but my goal was to put up pictures of my family, you know, as far back as I could get photos of. So I have my great-great-grandparents on there. But I wanted to do sort of half the wall my mother's side and half the wall my father's side. And I was digging through photos because I wanted to put a little picture of me in there too. And I found this one maybe from, I don't know, second grade or something. But it's just me sitting wearing this really cool outfit of like purple jeans and like a floral shirt. And I had a basketball on my knee. And I was like, yeah, that I really resonate with that version of myself. And sort of like also around the time when I had like really early interactions with girls, friends of mine, and yeah, just sort of like really embodied really in myself, really sort of able to feel some freedom in who I was. And at the same time, it was also, you know, shortly after divorce and being in a new family. And so just a lot going on in that little kid's place, and understanding that and having compassion for it, and also recognizing I'm not in such a dissimilar place right now. Yeah.
So I know that you've heard this question asked by so many professional interviewers. So I will end with it as well, because it connects to what you were just speaking about. So what is the thing, or what would you say you, mm-hmm. the adult woman,
okay.
say to that little girl, mm-hmm. knowing all that you know now, yeah. and your experiences, what would you say to her? Why don't we end with you giving her a bit of chatting?
I've never heard, well, that's not true. I've heard this question in therapy. It's the only other time. wow. I don't know, that's really hard. I think just like having immense love and compassion for that young person. You know, it's, that's what I needed the most at that time. And yeah, I don't know. To say that it's all going to be okay, I don't know, because it is and it isn't. Yeah. Maybe just to be outside more. that would have been the thing. I was looking back at where I lived with my mom when my parents divorced. I grew up in Chicago proper, and then my mom moved about an hour outside. My family didn't really grow up connected to nature. They mostly grew up in cities in the Soviet Union. And so when my mom moved, we moved to a place. It was sort of rural, suburban. And I started looking at Google Maps maybe a couple years ago, just looking at the old house I lived in and that area. And I realized, oh, wow, it's like full of lakes and a lot of preserves and open spaces. And yeah, I can't regret it because we didn't know. We weren't people that were in tune with the natural world in that way. My parents were just trying to like put food on the table. So I had a lot of autonomy as a child to go out and do whatever. And so, yeah, I would just say to like be outside more, like go to the water more, or go to the, we had a preserve like right behind our neighborhood, and yeah, that would be it. I'm glad I figured that out.
I'm glad to hear you laughing. So I want you to laugh just one more time. So I have one more question. I lied. Okay. One more. What brings you joy? What makes you joyful?
Yeah, being myself without worrying about what anybody else thinks. And yesterday was Pride Parade, and I got to march, and it was so joyful just to be there with my queer family and feel seen and supported and freaky and, you know, just all the parts of me, and like not giving a fuck. Yeah. That's what I always want to feel. And yeah.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. It has been a pleasure.
Yeah.
This concludes the interview with Audrey Berman.